Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have one of our most popular guests joining us again live in the studio here, John Stauber, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, author of numerous books, including most recently Best War Ever with Sheldon Rathman. Will be joining us to talk about his work, about the state of the progressive politics today, the anti-war movement, the Democratic Party, and many other issues of great interest to you, our listeners. So join us today for Media Matters. But first, before we go to John Stauber, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Music fans recently got a taste of what's in store for the internet without net neutrality. During a webcast of this year's Lollapalooza concert in Chicago, AT&T cut off the feed when Pearl Jam's lead singer, Eddie Vedder, sang lyrics critical of President George Bush. AT&T claims that the cut was a mistake and an isolated incident, but Pearl Jam posted a statement on its website calling the incident a wake-up call, something much bigger than the censorship of a rock band. And it turned out Pearl Jam isn't the only band that's been muzzled. AT&T has admitted political comments about the war in Iraq and Hurricane Katrina were cut from the webcast of the Bonnaroo Festival in Tennessee last June. Michael Bracey, Policy Director of Future of Music Coalition, says media consolidation and federal policymakers are allowing corporate gatekeepers to shape internet content.
The core issue is that you've had a small number of companies becoming dominant players in how consumers or citizens get access to the internet, and these companies have actively worked to change the laws and change the regulations in a way that give them the ability to exert unprecedented control over their pipeline. And the fact that this is exactly what the hypothetical concern would be, that a company like AT&T would create content, but then would choose to censor that content and would also be one of the dominant players in terms of how you access the content at home. I mean, it's a window into the future potential concern that we all feel in terms of neutrality.
That AT&T would censor political lyrics and speech was a silly thing to do, Bracey says, but that brought the issue of net neutrality to the fore.
It makes crystal clear what the concern is. Can we afford in this country to allow the future technologies to be controlled by corporations like this who, for very arbitrary whims, can say this political speech we allow or that political speech we don't allow? The danger is if the promise of the internet is replaced by basically a proprietary high-speed network controlled by a couple of those providers. And for many people, it quote-unquote feels like the internet because you have email, you have digital files, you have websites, but it really doesn't fill the promise of what these technologies can and should bring.
For more information about the Future of Music Coalition and their upcoming 7th Annual Future of Music Policy Summit in Washington, D.C., go to futureofmusiccoalition.org/rockthenet.
Increased consolidation of radio ownership over the past decade has made it difficult for local communities to get their voices on the air. But this October, the Federal Communications Commission will be opening a rare window for issuing full-power, non-commercial radio licenses. These new stations will be powerful, broadcasting at anywhere from 100 watts to 10,000 watts, depending on their geographic location. Ursula Rudenberg is the affiliates coordinator of Pacifica Radio, which is part of a national coalition of organizations called Radio for People that is working to help nonprofit and community groups interested in owning a radio station.
Community radio, because it is such an accessible media, really in some ways still functions as the virtual town square, a place for people to really talk about what they need to talk about with each other.
Radio for People has been working to encourage groups to apply for the licenses and helping navigate the complexities of the applications. Todd Urich, from coalition member Common Frequency, says that one reason his organization was founded was to help groups prepare for opportunities such as this one.
Common Frequency sort of had the vision of finding applicants that would start community radio stations open to all members of the public, from Spanish language programming to college kids doing underground music. Basically, everybody working together on one frequency. The more diversity, the better.
But time is running short for groups interested in applying. With less than 2 months remaining, applicants will have to be committed and prepared to invest in an engineer and a lawyer to help prepare the application. Libby Reinisch of the Prometheus Radio Project believes that since this is probably the last time a frequency will be available in most cities and towns, it is well worth the effort.
If you call us today, if you get started right now, you'll still have time to get your application in. And Prometheus and the rest of the Radio for People Coalition are here answering phone calls, answering all your questions about the window, and helping you get your application in tip-top shape.
To find out if there may be a frequency available in your town or city, visit getradio.org to enter your zip code. For additional information on community radio, visit the Radio for People website at radioforpeople.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got John Stauber joining us today live. In the studio here, John Stauber, the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, which produces the publication PR Watch, which I think many of you are familiar with, author with his running mate Sheldon Rampton of several books, very well-known books, most recently The Best War Ever, and also on his own, an activist who's been involved in progressive and populist politics now for a good 15 or 20 years on a variety of issues. And most recently has been quite active in the anti-war movement and working with progressives to try to make a more effective anti-war movement in the electoral arena and everywhere, for that matter. John Stauber, welcome to Media Matters.
It's great to be on the show, Bob.
And John, if I'm not mistaken, you were in Chicago recently for the yearly Coast Convention, and you had a very interesting experience there, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I don't know how familiar the radio audience is with the whole concept of Netroots, the blogosphere, Daily Coast, Yearly Coast. But over the last 5 years, of course, one of the most important places for progressive, liberal, democratic politics has been online. And since 2003, we've seen how opposition to the war in Iraq has merged with liberal politics. The whole Howard Dean campaign showed that an insurgent candidate without big money could raise $50 million through appealing over the internet and through building an online presence. Now, he wasn't able to win a meaningful primary, but still, that really got people's attention. And the Yearly Coast is an annual convention. It brought together in Chicago about 1,500 liberal, lefty, progressive, democratic bloggers, people who are very active online. And there's
and
also...
And it's based out of this Daily Coast website.
Right. It's inspired by the Daily Coast website, but it's not actually, as I understand it, a convention organized by Marcos, who has the Daily Coast mm-hmm. website. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting. Almost all the presidential candidates, the Democratic presidential candidates, were there. Many of the Democratic congressional leadership planned to be there. But since Bush kept them in Washington, where frankly they kowtowed to Bush and passed some really outrageous legislation that civil libertarians have been objecting to for a long time, they were not able to make their appointment at the Yearly Coast. But Obama was there, Hillary Clinton was there, John Edwards was there, Dennis Kucinich was there. All to address the liberal blogosphere.
So basically, the Yearly Coast, the liberal blogosphere since 2004, has really become a major force in Democratic Party politics. I mean, it's you can't skip this event if you're trying to be president of the United States.
That's absolutely the opinion of the presidential candidates, and I think, in fact, that's accurate. And just in the past week, there's a new book out called The Argument by a New York Times reporter that talks about something I've been analyzing and very interested in, especially since last November, this new power base inside the Democratic Party made up of organizations like Move On. People were well represented at the Yearly Coast, for instance. Of course, Move On has an email list of 3.3 million political progressives and liberals in the U.S., and it has become the second largest PAC money contributor to Democratic candidates, appealing to that list and then funneling money from the base up to Democrats. And so this new book, The Argument, looks at how organizations like Move On, the liberal blogosphere, the so-called A-list bloggers like Matt Stoller and Marcos and Chris Bowers, organizations like the Democracy Alliance. These might be names that a lot of people haven't heard about, which is why I'm mentioning the book, The Argument, have become a very important power within the party, especially since they've linked up with Andy Stern and SEIU.
The Service Employees Union.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's really important for people who care about social change, who care about politics, whatever their stripe or interest, especially people who identify with the word progressive, to take a look at what's no longer some sort of phenomena, but a real power in the party, the convergence of what I've been talking about.
And the Yearly Coast, being this annual convention, draws a lot of these people together.
I mean, draws all of them.
This is their convention. And it links all these new forces within the Democratic Party who are actively trying to work to certainly have the Democratic Party be successful, but also are they trying to change the Democratic Party, too, from... In a way, from how it's operated in the past?
Well, I think that's a really good question, because certainly people like Jerome Armstrong and Marcos Melitzis of the Daily Coast.
Yeah, who's been a guest on this program?
Yeah, they had a book out, came out about a year ago, called Crashing the Gates. Mm-hmm. And, of course, what they have been arguing and saying for years now is the Democratic Party is controlled by this moneyed elite, beholden to corporations, you know, not all that different from the Republican Party. And the Democratic Party needs to be changed. And that's, you know, what the liberal blogosphere is all about. But now, in November, I would say the gates have been crashed, and a lot of these people have always been Democratic Party campaign consultants. Now they're very much inside the Democratic Party, and there is this new power base. And I think they're no longer outsiders. In fact, when I look at what's going on, and Sheldon Rampton and I have analyzed this in terms of the war with a piece we wrote, I believe, in February titled Why Won't Move On Move Forward? I think what's happening now is that a lot of positions are being actually managed with an eye not towards, for instance, ending the war, but towards managing the war and the politics around the war in a way that Democratic campaign consultants think will best help Democratic candidates in 2008. And I haven't had time to read Matt Bowers' book, The Argument. I literally picked it up this morning. But I skipped ahead to the last page. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because there was that same argument. It was he was quoting Mario Cuomo, who was referring to the war in Iraq rather crassly as a gift to the Democrats. And certainly that's exactly, from my analysis, what it was last November. I mean, let's face it, the Democratic Party has never been an anti-war party. Obviously, the loudest voices against the war, people like Russ Feingold, Barbara Lee, and others, have been Democrats. But it's been a two-party war. It's very much a two-party war now, since the Democrats are continuing to fund it. And it's interesting to look at how the anti-war movement that is identified with the Democratic Party and Move On, in the form of a coalition called Americans Against the Escalation in Iraq, a coalition that's probably already spent $15 million in so far a failed effort to end the surge and is organizing an Iraq summer, only targets Republican candidates and has taken the tactical position of not targeting Democrats who are pro-war.
And that, and I know from your writings and from talking to you that this is a position you oppose, that you think this is wrong, that that Move On, Daily Coast, Yearly Coast, all these people who are this sort of new force in the Democratic Party who ostensibly are progressives should use their power to be much more critical of existing Democrats.
Well, I wouldn't quite state my position that way,
okay.
But that's not far off.
Well, state it the way you like.
I will. I personally really believe that democracy is based at the grassroots. And I'm an independent. I'm not a member of any party. And my organization is strictly nonpartisan. What we are is pro-democracy. And I think what a healthy democracy has, it has powerful, independent groups at the grassroots, and politicians and parties are accountable to the people. So I look at the war in Iraq. Sheldon Rampton and I have written two books for the center analyzing the propaganda that sold the war. Mm-hmm. It's no secret that we were against the war in 2003 because it was obviously going to be the sort of disastrous quagmire it's become. It was sold on deceit. And so I do identify as part of the movement to end the war. I think what we really need in America is what we saw flash in that November election. The public is against the war. That's how the Democrats ended up in control of Congress. It wasn't, again, because they're an anti-war party. It was because the Republicans were voted against because they're a pro-war party.
Yeah.
And you've now seen how the most recent survey that was quoted in a recent Alexander Coburn piece titled How the Democrats Blew It in 8 Months, points out that a survey found that public opinion of Congress is at its lowest level in about 35 years. Public opinion of this Congress is lower than it was of the Republican Congress a year ago, much mm-hmm. lower. And I think that the public is against the war. They thought they voted against the war. And yet here you have the Democratic Party allied with groups like Move On, claiming to be anti-war and yet funding the war. Clearly, from the perspective of what do we need to do in this country to end the war, we need to see that both political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, stop managing the war from a political perspective and start doing what the public wants, which is ending the war and getting U.S. troops out of Iraq. So that's my personal perspective.
Our guest today on Media Matters is John Stauber, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, the group which produces PR Watch. What's the website, John?
www.prwatch.org.
PRwatch.org. Author with Sheldon Rampton of numerous books, including The Best War Ever, the most recent book. He's here on the phones with us. If you'd like to, you can call in at 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open as we speak. You know, this is a long prolegomenon. I think that's the correct word.
I'm not even going to try to pronounce it.
It's a tongue twister already. To the initial question, which was your incident or episode at the Yearly Coast Conference, which was a meeting of all these folks, their annual meeting with the presidential candidates, and you went there thinking this would be a good opportunity to raise this issue and discuss exactly what the proper relationship of progressives and Democrats should be to the war and the anti-war movement.
Right. I took a look at the schedule for Yearly Coasts. And after all, I live in Madison, Wisconsin, a short little drive down to Chicago where the Yearly Coast Convention was held. And it just stunned me that looking at the Yearly Coast schedule, there wasn't a single meaningful workshop or seminar on the Iraq War. I mean, here are 1,500 grassroots bloggers, the overwhelming uniting issue, as many people have pointed out, including Marcos, is anti-war. And there were a few workshops that mildly touched on it. One that I attended that was interesting, but it certainly really wasn't a chance to debate how to end the war, was Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg, partner with James Carville, advisor to Move On. He does Move On's polling. And Tom Matzie, the Move On lobbyist, talking about what the polls are showing right now. Ostensibly, that was supposed to mention Iraq. It barely mentioned Iraq. They mainly pointed out, along with some other pollsters, that if the election were held today, it would be Mitt Romney versus Hillary Clinton, which I think is really interesting because when you look at the leading Democratic Party candidates, they aren't anti-war. In fact, Hillary, who most pollsters think right now is the likely candidate, although God knows it's a long way off.
That's right.
It's very clear that, as she says, when she's president in 2009, she will keep U.S. troops in Iraq, but she will manage the war more smartly. So, you know, I was really quite shocked that there wasn't a meaningful session on the war, and I decided there needed to be one. Center for Media and Democracy contacted leadership of Iraq Veterans Against the War, very interesting, nonpartisan, independent, grassroots groups of professional soldiers, both active duty and veterans, who've been through the mill in Iraq and are personally speaking out, some of them at great personal cost, about what this war is about and about why they are absolutely committed to stopping it. And this is not a Democratic group. It's obviously not a Republican group. They criticize politicians of all stripes on their failure to end the war in Iraq. So I brought Garrett Reppenhagen, the national board chair, Aaron Hughes, the Chicago chapter president of IVAW, and some others to a session at the Early Coast on Sunday morning when there was absolutely nothing else scheduled. And we called it Coffee with the Troops. Interesting thing was, once I set it up, I contacted Early Coast and I said, hey, you know, we've got this great event set up. Would you mind just putting it on your schedule? And they refused to put it on their schedule. So I showed up at Early Coast with about 800 flyers and distributed those. The conference was tremendously well attended. And tomorrow we're putting up the entire session, I should say, was tremendously well attended. We're putting the entire session up on YouTube so everyone out there can view it. And, you know, when you sit down, young anti-war soldiers, combat veterans of Iraq, and let them tell their story, as one of them, Aaron Hughes, said, it doesn't really matter how that soldier feels about the war. Those stories are powerful, and that's the information that hasn't been getting out, and that's what the blogosphere, I felt, needed to hear and interact with. And I think that's part of the problem with the war dragging on, is the mainstream media sold this war, and the mainstream media is failing to really convey to the American people exactly how horrific this war is, especially for these troops. You know, in Vietnam, if you were drafted or, you know, you're a member of the volunteer army, you went to Vietnam, your tour of duty was 1 year. As Garrett Reppenhagen pointed out, 75% of the soldiers, U.S. soldiers, who've been in this war in Iraq, which is now over 4 years old, are not yet veterans. Some of these men and women are on their third or fourth tour. They're taking people with post-traumatic stress syndrome and sending them back under treatment. You know, we're now enlisting felons into the army, because it's so hard finding soldiers to fight this war. And these are the stories, I think, that really need to get out, because however you feel politically, I think for the good of the country, the good of the nation, it's important to make decisions about the war on the reality, and that's why we brought Iraq Veterans Against the War to Early Coast.
Before we go to the phone lines, I want to follow up on that point, John Stauber. You've written the book with Sheldon Rampton, a couple of books now, actually, on the Iraq War and the press coverage and the spin surrounding the Iraq invasion and occupation. That now is almost accepted by and large across the board, that the period of press coverage in 2001 to 2003 leading up to the invasion, the first month of the invasion, initial occupation, journalists now concede, journalism experts now concede, okay, drop the ball there, missed that one, blew it. But there have been mea culpas. Has the press coverage seriously improved since then? Are we now on better footing? And I see we've got, okay, good, we took care of that. Our line five is now over. So what's your assessment of the current news media, U.S. news media coverage of the war? Has it dramatically improved? They learned from the mistakes.
No, it's not dramatically improved at all. There have been mea culpas. There have been individual journalists who have really spoken out and said, we blew it, we were manipulated, we're sorry. But when I look at and analyze the overall mainstream corporate news media, they're absolutely continuing to fail the American people in providing the information and analysis that we need to understand what's going on in Iraq, understand the continuing neoconservative push to expand this war into Iran and Syria. Here's an example. In June of 2006, the Center for Media and Democracy exposed this group called Vets for Freedom. as a neoconservative front group that was being coordinated by White House PR operatives like Taylor Gross, that was claiming to be an independent voice of U.S. soldiers who supported the mission, when in fact it was clearly sort of a swift boat Veterans for Peace. In fact, with some of the same Republican operatives involved. Mm-hmm. That was June of 2006. And this group, Veterans for Freedom, which you can Google online, you'll get their website as the first return. And our website, our SourceWatch website, exposing what they're really about is your second return. Until we took that hard look at them, you know, in June of 2006 and exposed their real purpose as a front group for neoconservative, pro-war Republican politics, they'd already been placing op-eds in major papers like the New York Times. They were going unanalyzed. They were being quoted. Now they've really shown their neoconservative colors, and they're getting an awful lot of money and running TV ad campaigns now in half a dozen states, supporting pro-war candidates from Norm Coleman to Joe Lieberman. But if you read most of the mainstream reporting, you don't get any of that sort of background and analysis. You just read, oh, gee, look, at the vets are pro-war. Here's this group, Vets for Freedom. You know, they really completely support the president. And most of the reports that are on them don't say, oh, P.S., by the way, they're essentially an arm of the White House and supporting the war as neoconservatives.
Our guest today on Media Matters, John Stauber, who you've just been listening to, the executive director for the Center for Media and Democracy. Today we're talking about the peace movement, the anti-war movement, and the efforts by activists like John Stauber to get the progressive community and the liberal community engaged with this issue in a more forceful and, I think, in your view, more effective manner to make the anti-war movement successful.
And let me just say something, Bob. I don't think the anti-war movement is just a left or liberal movement. You know, it was a little shocking to a lot of us to be involved in debates in 2002 and 2003 and hear that one of the strongest, most eloquent voices absolutely opposing the U.S. attack in Iraq was Pat Buchanan. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a tradition within the Republican Party that doesn't support wars of empire. And Pat Buchanan had this great quote. I remember listening to him on one of the syndicated NPR programs talking, and he said, we don't want empire. We don't want to be an empire. What happens to empires? They collapse. And, you know, if you look at what's happened with this war, it was all predicted by the anti-war movement, whether we're talking about Pat Buchanan or whether we're talking about that fantastic New York Times ad that ran from TomPayton.com that was a visual takeoff on the Uncle Sam Wants You recruiting poster, but it was Uncle Osama Wants You to attack Iraq.
Yeah.
And now the general consensus is, oh, wow, was this a gift to Osama bin Laden or what? Well, yeah, but there were hundreds of thousands of people in the street. There were millions of people opposed to this war. There were ads in the New York Times because you couldn't get coverage for that point of view. So there were ads in the New York Times saying, hey, attacking Iraq, this is a gift to Osama bin Laden, you idiots.
It's also, in a way, I guess, a gift to Iran. You said that the Bush administration wanted to desperately, the neocons have Iran in their sights. That's the next country they'd like to bring democracy to. And but at the same time, if you've got the troops in Iraq stretched so thin, they're bringing felons and forcing soldiers to stay there for three or four terms of duty. Is it at all? I mean, right now, do they have the troop strength to go back into Grenada, let alone consider going into a powerful nation of 70 or 75 million people?
I don't think the U.S. could roll into Champaign Urbana right now. No, we've decimated our military, and this is another one of the stories that the vets really tell best themselves. For instance, Aaron Hughes, who enlisted years and years ago, you know, and was a member of the Illinois National Guard. That was his motivation, to be able to especially be in the Guard and work in things like protecting Illinois cities from floods on the Mississippi. And where are we at with just our National Guard here at home? They're decimated. The vehicles aren't there. The men and women aren't there. You know, Colin Powell and even some of Bush's generals are saying our military hits a wall next summer. I mean, what do? We just keep sending these people who've been there on 2, 3, 4 tours back. So I think if you step back and you try to analyze this neoconservative policy that misled America into war and is advocating for expanding the war into Syria and Iran, and you try to analyze it logically, it's very difficult, except that I think one thing the United States can always do is it can say, well, things are so bad, we have to step it up. We have to increase the war effort. We have to go to war in Iran. We have to have a draft. And frankly,
I wonder where Bush's approval ratings go after that.
Yeah, you know, where do they go? You know, it was interesting last year when our book, The Best War Ever, came out, reading the book Fiasco. Mm-hmm. By Thomas Ricks, the Pentagon reporter for the Washington Post. And, you know, that book that Sheldon and I wrote, The Best War Ever, didn't have any, you know, particularly new insights. It was really a follow-up to Weapons of Mass Deception. And the question we were trying to answer is, what happens when a country believes its own propaganda and then pursues this disastrous policy? So it's nice when somebody like Ricks, who dines every day if he wants to with, you know, the top generals and admirals in the Pentagon, weighs in with the book. And it's very difficult for anyone to figure out what the real rationale is behind this neoconservative U.S. foreign policy. Some people think it is to create chaos, to create a warfare state, and to be able to expand upward from there. And we've seen how steadily the neoconservative voices like William Kristol and Newt Gingrich and others who were behind the Project for a New American Century have been advocating expanding the war. And you mentioned Iran. Of course, one of the great ironies, too, is that the darling of these neoconservatives was the Iraq National Congress, a front group started by the CIA to lobby us with our own money to go to war. And Ahmed Chalabi Iraqi of with Iranian connections, with a nice house in Iran, who was going to be the new George Washington of Iraq in the eyes of people like Cheney, is now seen by many of these neoconservatives as maybe he was an Iranian agent all along, because what we've essentially done is we've delivered the control of the official government in Iraq to Iranian interests, and now the U.S. is all upset with Iranian influence when it was U.S. foreign policy that brought this about.
Our guest, John Stauber, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. We have a couple phone lines open at 333-9455 and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now with some very patient callers. Line 4, Farina, you're on the air with John Stauber.
Hi. What a great opportunity to talk to, you know, such intellectuals. I don't know. The thing I'd like to comment on is like democracy means nothing if the vote is manipulated by, you know, these electronic voting machines or just out and out vote rigging, and the democracy depends on truth is the criterion. It just has to be. The perception of confidence in the system, in the monetary system, in the political system, it's all perception. And if you could comment on that. And then I just got a million things, but one other thing, the Soviet air patrols reestablished last week with bombers. What's that about? Okay, and thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you very much. Before you go to the Soviet air patrol, if you know much about that, I don't. The whole question of stolen elections, does the center or do you have a dog in that race?
Well, we have a dog in the small d democracy race in general. We are small staff. We haven't gotten into investigating what's gone on with charges of stolen elections. But people like Joel Bleifuss, the editor of In These Times, mm-hmm. Good Illinois-based publication, for instance, have concluded that indeed the last election was stolen.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., there are more than a few people.
Exactly. And you have other people like Mark Crispin Miller said, no, I don't think so. But I think the bottom line, Bob, is...
No, I think he says it's been stolen, doesn't he?
Mark Crispin Miller...
he's going to be a guest this fall.
Ask him.
New book. I'm going to let Mark speak for himself. Now.
Thank you. Do that. I'm flashing back to a debate he was on with Democracy Now! And now that I think of it, I think you're right.
Okay.
Yeah. The bottom line here is what democracy? You know, only half or less of Americans, even in this political environment, bother to go out and vote. As your caller alluded to, yeah, one reason is people are losing confidence that the votes can even be counted correctly. But also, what's going on in the system? There's going to be more money spent on the 2008 presidential race and other races than at any time in American history. Every 4 years, a new record is spent. How much of that money? I'll tell you how much. Hundreds of millions of dollars is going to go into smear TV ads that are designed to drive down the vote and smear candidates just short of slander and libel to really corrupt any meaningful discussion debate. Meanwhile, as Free Press and others have pointed out, when you look at the news media, and most Americans unfortunately get most of their news from TV journalism, which more and more is just an oxymoron, the coverage of campaigns from TV news is decreased while they're raking in these hundreds of millions to run these attack ads. So we have an incredibly corrupted political system that, despite the best efforts of reformers like Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, is in worse shape than ever. And that, I think, is important to keep in mind, that whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, a Libertarian, a Green, or you just don't even care, our political system is a shared monopoly of two parties with more and more special interest money than ever driving ultimately what they do.
John Stauber, a recent edition of The Economist magazine had a cover story on the state of American politics, and it noted, this is in The Economist, mind you, that 45% of Americans are now in favor of impeachment of President Bush, and I assume Vice President Cheney, including 12% of Republicans. Yet, interestingly enough, this is an issue that almost is nowhere to be found in our news media. I mean, you simply can look high and low, and there's almost no coverage. Yet, it has this an astonishing amount of support at this level. When you were at the Yearly Coast, did you find a lot of discussion and a lot of sessions on impeachment? Was it a big topic?
Well, it was interesting because anyone could buy a booth space at the Yearly Coast, and so you had all sorts of organizations and candidates, you know, with their booths hawking their position. And there were a number of organizations, such as World Can't Wait and others, PDA, I believe, pushing impeachment. And yet there wasn't any meaningful session at the Yearly Coast on this whole issue of impeachment. And I think what's happening is there's sort of, and of course, you know, I'm sure people would take exception with this and say, show us some proof. But I think what's happening is there's sort of a self-censorship now that's occurring within big D Democratic circles. And some things are just off the table. And when the Democrats took over Congress in November, one of the very first pronouncements from Nancy Pelosi was impeachment is off the table. Mm. I think what happens as elections approach is that people become political partisans, and a lot of people who are just so hungry for the Democrats to take the White House go, okay, we've got our marching orders, impeachment is off the table. And that seems to have been a position that the Democrats gave a lot of thought to and formally announced last November. And so I think, well, why isn't the media pushing impeachment? I mean, we know we have this...
Or even mentioning it.
We know we have this sort of cowardly media, and often they will point to the fact that, well, neither the Democratic leadership nor the Republican leadership is pushing that position, so apparently it doesn't have any traction. You know, we see that in debates over health care. The last time there was a meaningful health care debate, they said, well, neither the Democrats or Republicans are really pushing single payer. It's a non-issue, so we use that to justify the fact that we're not going to point out that the U.S. is the only industrial nation in the world that doesn't have some sort of single-payer guaranteed system. It's not a story. It's not news here because the Republicans and Democrats aren't talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
our guest, John Stauber. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air with John Stauber. Line one, are you there? I think we might have lost line one, unfortunately. The number here for those who would like to call in, 333-9455. Toll free number 1-800-222-9455. I just heard from my producer we might have Urbana back in line one. Are you there, Urbana? I gather not. Well, we'll see what happens if Urbana calls back. We certainly will make room for them.
By the way, my aging middle-aged memory, yes. You're correct. Mark Crispin Miller was arguing that the election was stolen. It was Mark Hertzberg.
Okay.
Who was arguing, no, it wasn't really stolen. Mark Hertzberger wrote On Bended Knee in the 80s about the Reagan White House. But yeah, sure. Mark Crispin Miller is one of the really leading voices who's saying stolen election.
You know, one of the big issues that took place in the last 3 or 4 weeks in the anti-war movement came when a number of anti-war activists, including Medea Benjamin, Lennox Yearwood, occupied John Conyers' office at the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
John Conyers, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, which handles impeachment proceedings in the House, which would bring impeachment charges before the whole floor of the House, and has not been willing to do so. And there was an occupation in his office by Medea Benjamin, Lennox Yearwood, Cindy Sheehan, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm not 100% sure Cindy was there. And it was a big controversy in Democratic and anti-war circles, with a lot of issues of sort of racism involved toward by anti-war activists toward John Conyers. What was your take on that episode? And if I conveyed it accurately, because I don't want to misrepresent it.
Well, there certainly is a debate around whether this was appropriate for people to occupy the office of Conyers, who, by the way, is one of the most left-leaning people in the House. But just personally, I think, you know, that if this is the person in charge of a really important decision-making regarding an issue, you've got to expect people willing to do civil disobedience actions to maybe show up in your office. You know, and I think there is a lot of frustration among progressive activists that the Democratic Party on the war, on impeachment, on investigations of what has come down under these years of one-state Republican rule are simply dropping the ball. And I think that, you know, the real issue for to look at there isn't the color makeup of the people in the office, or the people holding the office, but the question of why won't the Democratic Party do what independent activists expect them to do. And again, I'm nonpartisan. I think one thing that's happening now is that a lot of progressive activists are sort of shaping their politics with an eye towards 2008 and I think you see that especially with organizations like Move On, which is now the leading funder, or second leading PAC funder of Democratic candidates. They can move a lot of money. And the big prize now is 2008, and can Democrats take control of the White House? Well, I just came back yesterday from a convention in St. Louis of independent anti-war groups, the Veterans for Peace Convention, which also included the Convention of Iraq Veterans Against the War. These are people committed to stopping the war, and they're extremely distraught, especially, as you can imagine, the Iraq soldiers and veterans that, as one said to me, yeah, you know, my buddies are dying because these people want to wait till November 08 to do something. I mean, they are angry, very angry. And that's how I think a lot of anti-war activists are now viewing the Democratic Party, whereas people in the party would say, well, you know, there's just so much you can do. You got to have the White House, yada, yada. So I think we're going to see a continuing fissure between independent, anti-war, pro-impeachment activists and Democratic Party-identified activists. But frankly, when I look at you know, where we're going politically, I think where we're going to be a year from now is we're going to have two presidential candidates, obviously, one from the Republican Party, one from the Democratic Party, and I think they're going to be almost indistinguishable on what to do about the war. I think they're both going to be saying, if I'm elected, I will responsibly bring an end to this occupation in Iraq. And I think it's going to be a situation where a lot of voters are going to look at it the way they looked at John Kerry and George Bush and say, I really can't tell the difference between these two on Iraq. I'm 54 years old. I remember the peace candidate who won election in 1968. His name was Richard Nixon, and he had a secret plan to end the war, which was threatening to bomb the North with nuclear weapons. Henry Kissinger convinced him that wouldn't be a very good idea in the face of a massive anti-war movement. And it really, alarms me to see the Democratic Party now doing what I think they're doing, trying to co-opt the anti-war movement into a movement to get Democrats elected in 08. I think the 08 election is going to be between two candidates, neither of whom are going to be taking the necessary steps, if or when elected, to get the U.S. occupation troops out of Iraq. This war is not going to end anytime soon, from my perspective, if the two political parties continue to manage it the way they are.
John Stauber, the second part of the question had something to do with Soviet reconnaissance flights. Do you know anything about this?
I can only assume the caller is probably reflecting what seems to be the reemergence of the Cold War, with the Bush administration insisting that they're going to put rockets into former Soviet bloc countries to shoot down missiles should they ever be placed in Iran, and Putin saying, oh, no, you're not. So in the midst of everything else going on in the world over the last 6 months, with not a lot of attention paid to it in the U.S. press, but quite a bit in the European press where I was in the spring, there is this new Cold War that seems to be heating up.
John Stauber from Center for Media and Democracy, author of many books, including The Best War Ever, joining us today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, we have a few callers waiting patiently. Let's go back to the phone line so we can get them all in. Let's start with line one, now from Champaign. You're on the air with John Stauber.
Hi, thank you for the program. I have kind of an odd observation. I'm a independent with very liberal leanings. From time to time, I watch O'Reilly just to see how crazy it is on the other side. And I happened one day to hear him deriding in a crazy way the Daily Coast, which at the time I'd never heard of. So I went straight to that site, and now I go all the time and realize that O'Reilly steered probably a lot of first-time visitors to that site. Everything you hear about is toward more polarization. I think that whether accidental help from O'Reilly did something that many other efforts don't. Can you suggest ways that we can preach beyond the choir, that we can get more people aware of liberal thinking?
Thank you very much, caller. And John, before you answer that, John Stauber, let me just sort of preface that by asking you to comment on something you mentioned before we went on air, which is that, you know, in the minds of many people like O'Reilly or mainstream media in general, not just conservatives in the media, when you mention Daily Coast or Move On, you know, they think that is the outer limits of possible left-wing, anti-war, liberal, progressive politics. I mean, there's nothing about it. So when you come along and are critical of this branch of the Democratic Party, it puts you off in like a different dimension from anything they know.
Well, again, as probably listeners to your show know well, in the mainstream U.S. corporate media, we have a political spectrum that runs from sort of the conservative moderate center to the far right wacko. We don't have left progressive, liberal, left independent views and articles and stories in our corporate media. So when something happens, like the emergence of your Daily Coast as a real power, or the election of a woman speaker who's one of the most liberal Democrats in Congress, Nancy Pelosi from San Francisco, my God, to a lot of people who are sort of stuck in this stunted spectrum, the Marxist-Leninists have just seized Washington and are holding a convention called Yearly COS. Now, Bill O'Reilly, he likes to throw fresh meat to his own audience, and so he needs to vilify anyone who is on the right, and occasionally he needs to poke at somebody on the right just so he can claim that he's actually an objective centrist, which he likes to do, not an extremist himself. But, all you have to do is talk to Al Franken, and you can find out how good Bill O'Reilly can be at giving publicity to issues and selling books. Al Franken often jokes about how O'Reilly's stupid insistence that Franken's book
Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them.
Right, was turned into a New York Times bestseller by O'Reilly insisting that his people sue for inferring that he's a liar, and that gave that book more publicity than any book campaign possibly could have. In terms of reaching out, I'm not a partisan Democrat. Obviously, I'm not a partisan Republican. I grew up in a very conservative Republican family. It was being a high school activist working against the Vietnam War that made me who I am. I'm a committed populist. I think we need to see a movement in this country that empowers people at the grassroots. That's where politics should be in a democracy. And I think the best way to reach out is get involved in issues you care about at the local level and get out there and talk with the people in your community. Now, these days, you can also do an awful lot online, the so-called netroots. I think in some ways, from the standpoint of organizing an independent progressive movement, whether it's to save the earth, to stop the war, to feed the hungry, things have never been so good because you can literally, as this broadcast is, reach around the world through the internet and get heard. Or you can also walk out your door in Champaign-Urbana and start talking with the neighbors down the street who might have the support the troops, support the surge sign.
Our guest, John Starver, let's go back to the phone lines, try to get our callers in before the program ends in a few minutes.
Hello?
Line two, Urbana,
Hello.
You're on the air with John Starver.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for the program. I was moved to call when you were talking about anti-war Iraq vets being shut out of the media, or even, indeed, Iraq vets just talking about their experiences, because we've experienced that locally, too, as well as nationally. The Nation did that investigation, which hasn't been reported anywhere else, so they just talked to vets about their experiences. We've had events here where, in Urbana, we're the only reporter that showed up, and I'm thinking like three events in the last several weeks, where the only reporter who showed up was a reporter from WILL. I know that might sound cheesy to, promote the home team, but it did make me think every time, thank God that we have public radio here, and people maybe think, that public radio is like Prairie Home Companion, and doesn't occur to them that, like, sometimes it's our only chance to get the word out about some of these events, which are surely more newsworthy than some of the things that the TV stations and the newspaper were just a mile away. It wouldn't really cost them much in the doldrums of summer to cover, vets coming through town. So I don't know what the experiences in other places, maybe you know something about that, but it just makes me wonder, like, what about all the places in this country that don't have public broadcasting, that such events would get totally shut out?
Well, first of all, let me say something. Iraq Veterans Against the War, the website is ivaw.org. In my personal opinion, this is the most important anti-war, pro-peace, pro-troops organization in the country. It's independent. It's passionate. These are our soldiers. And just this Saturday in St. Louis, 90 soldiers, members of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, lined up to protest outside a recruiting fair targeting black potential military recruits in St. Louis. This was the largest action organized by Iraq veterans ever in the country, and it got one little mention in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I think that Iraq veterans need to be heard, and I would recommend going to ivaw.org.
We've got time for one last caller now. San Francisco, line four, you're on the air with John Stauber.
Hi. The best information in this whole program was about that convention. I had not heard of it. I did not know about it. If they reinstituted the draft right now, the Iraq War, the younger people that were actually subject to a draft would come out in the streets. Words matter. The Vietnam War was not a war. It was an occupation. The Iraq War is not a war. It's an occupation. Words do matter. They're screwing with their heads. One way Bush might be impeached, and you could sell this to a Republican, to say it's a CEO replacement because he's blown the budget. Okay, that's all I gotta say. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. John, we've only got a couple minutes left. And one thing to add on to the Iraq War veterans and their stories, because, you know, we've talked about that a lot, and it's a central part of what you've been talking about today. Give our listeners some sense of what you're hearing from Iraq veterans, from their experience in Iraq, what it's really like, what we aren't hearing in our news media, that, you know, what if you can, in a minute or two, just convey the stories that you're hearing that are so impressive to you.
Well, you know, I've always found, beginning with my dad, who was a World War II vet, that most soldiers don't like to talk with people who weren't there about what goes on in a war. And I think that's certainly true with soldiers coming back from Iraq. There have been some really good movies, one being The War Tapes, that look at this. But if you want to hear what the Iraq veterans are saying, later today at our website, prwatch.org, either today or tomorrow, you'll be able to actually view this entire session we put on at Yearly Coast, and this will be the Iraq Veterans Against the War talking directly about their experience and what they need to the blogosphere attendees at Yearly Coast.
Well, can you give us a little taste, though, for those of us who might be considering listening, going to your website or going bowling?
Yeah, one thing that really offends these men and women in Iraq Veterans Against the War is this idea that continuing this war of occupation, as your caller rightly called it, is somehow pro-troops, and that continuing to fund the war is pro-troops. You know, as Aaron Hughes said, he just said, excuse me, is that money going to us? Is that money helping the troops? Is that money dealing with PTSD? Is that money, did that buy us the body armor we didn't have? I mean, there is a rage about being exploited politically by the Republicans, but there's also a rage at being exploited by the Democrats, and there's a real growing sense among these Iraq veterans who are against the war that they've been sold out, and I think a lot of people coming out of the last election feel that. Why are Democrats funding this war? But Iraq veterans especially feel it.
You know, we've only got a few seconds left, John Stauber. I want to thank you for joining us. But real quickly, where should people go if they want to learn more about these issues? Besides your site, we've already talked about prwatch.org. What other news media do you look to for insight?
Well, I think on the war, it's very important to go to ivaw.org. Mm-hmm. You know, Alternet has become quite a media powerhouse. Alternet.org, CommonDreams.org. You get, as you know, Bob, just a good collection of daily news, that a lot of which is not in the mainstream.
John Stauber, thanks so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm Bob McChesney here on Media Matters, WILL AM 580. I'm going to be back in 167 hours with you, dear listeners. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, as always, for being my producer. We're going to have another guest for you live next week. And until then, have a great week. Bye-bye.